This is an ABC podcast.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour.
It certainly is, presented for the next little while by me, Virginia Trioli, sitting in for John Fain. Great to have your company. 6 minutes past 11 on ABC Radio Melbourne, Victoria, and wherever you get your fabulous podcasts. It's Science Week, which I'm tremendously excited about. So I'm delighted that my co-host is Tanya Ha, former reporter with Catalyst on ABC TV, national publicist for Science Week, broadcaster, communicator, consultant and advocate. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you advocate for, Tanya?
Science. You have to say it like that during Science Week. No, it's evidence-based policy, giving scientists the resources they need to help us, and women in science, that sort of thing, and particularly saving the planet, environmental science. That's where my roots are.
I think that's incredibly important. We've got some great people to talk to you from a scientific perspective a little later in the program, including Professor Toby Walsh. I don't know if he's worried about AI taking over. I love the idea of AI. Where does AI intersect in your life? If at all.
I'm trying to work that out. So that's the thing, is you don't necessarily know. The thing that it'd be in your phone. It'd be in the fact that, the certain loyalty cards seem to know exactly what cheese I like, and they're always sending me tantalizing emails based on algorithms when blue cheese is on special.
Oh, wow.
They know stuff.
when those ads started popping up, and I use one of those, proprietary email servers rather than a private one, when the ads started popping up and clearly they had been reading my emails, I did have a moment of terror then.
Yeah. It's a bit, so it's the stuff that you don't know about that makes me slightly uncomfortable. I do love a bit of sat-nav in my life. I suspect that there's
I won't complain about that.
Yeah. There are two questions I ask whenever a friend says that there's difficulty in her marriage or his marriage. I say, do you have sat-nav for driving and do you have a dishwasher? Because there's a few arguments that would be saved by...
And a cleaner.
Where's my robot cleaner?
Yeah, or even pay a human cleaner. But that will solve most marital problems. Mm. Did you say you've been doing some research?
I have been doing a little bit of research into what's happening during Science Week that might amuse you because as of next week, well, it'll either amuse you or annoy you.
Okay.
I thought,
go on.
Virginia's used to a certain type of co-host, so a certain type of puntastic co-host.
Oh, no, you're not going to. I got away from the puns.
Well, so my three favourite Science Week events that have puns in their titles. Parasites Lost, which is Alanta Colley. She is a Melbourne comedian and she works with NGOs.
That's very funny. I'll pay that.
Okay, yeah. So she works with NGOs in public health and so she was doing a comedy show, Melbourne Girl Doing Well in Sydney for Science Week, sharing her myriad of stories of parasites, the story of one woman who found she wasn't alone and there's lots of toilet humour. So that was a nice, funny, hilarious
event. Very funny. I like that. Number two,
tomorrow night in Canberra at Questacon, there's an event called Whiskey Business, looking at the science of alcoholic drinks. I must say that as people have tried to get away from the idea that Science Week is all about kids, there's quite a few events actually that are about wine science.
Because that's the only way to hook in the adults.
Well, and it kind of says, but partly that. And then this is my ultimate favourite. What do you call an event in which you're talking about the reproduction, i.e. the sex lives of crustaceans? You call it...
Let me guess. The sex life of crustaceans, you call it... I don't know. I don't have anything. Go.
50 Shades of Grey. So, hi, Michael. Getting her ready for her return.
So enjoying the break. But they're good puns.
They are, yes.
And these are terrible.
Okay, fair enough. My husband and I have arguments over. I'm generally on Michael's side and my husband's on your side.
I love your husband.
I've got a fine appreciation of a good pun and my husband says there's no such thing.
That's the point. I was just about to say there is no such thing. And even if there was a halfway decent one, they're never that good.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a tough time to be out there advocating for science? Are we living through a particularly non-believing time?
I think we are. It's that whole post-truth society. And there was a time when we just, we, if you go back hundreds of years, the people that you'd go to for, you know, the final say in things were the priests, you know, were the spiritual elders. Then, you know, after the Enlightenment, the, you know, you'd call in your expert witnesses, the scientists, and, you know, there was a real, I think, a good shift towards evidence-based policy. But lately we're in that, you know, Trump, fake news, that sort of thing, and where ideas can be contested and, you know, things that aren't true, misinformation spreads like wildfire. So it's hard.
I think there's a longer provenance to it than that. Mm. I was mentioning in the previous hour that I briefly studied overseas at New York University, and that was where I saw the beginnings of what I would have called then political correctness. It's not the thing that's called now. That clearly is something else. And I think it's a derogatory phrase that's often used to dismiss what should just be civilized behavior. But what yeah. I was seeing as a kind of emerging political correctness was around the idea that everyone's views was valid. Everyone had a point of view. Everyone gets a prize. And I was attending tutorials and discussions where it didn't matter if someone said something that was just manifestly wrong. What they were told by the tutor was, you know, that's a really interesting point of view. You know, I really like what you're trying to say there. And I'd be turning around and going, what do you mean? It's rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. She might fervently believe it, but it's actually rubbish and there's no basis for it. And what you're starting to see was the rise of the opinion over fact. Yeah. And I think, I don't know if it has something to do with the way that we've been raising children where, you know, every little thing out of their mouth is, you know, perfectly perfect. But that was problematic for me. And I think that's what's led to this time
of part of that.
It's all valid. What everyone thinks, and well, it's my opinion, for goodness sake. You can't yell at me because it's my opinion. Well, I can if your opinion is based in something that is absolutely wrong.
I think part of it is that people want that sense of equality, that there's not inferior and superior people. And the thing is that, and this is something that, because one of the things that I do is media train scientists. And like I often say to them, you know, do you realise that when you use that jargon, you make people feel stupid and they don't like feeling stupid?
Yes, but there are inferior and superior opinions and facts. There are.
Oh, yeah. But I think there's a way to engage and there's a way to talk about information and a way to contest it and to say, you know, to that lecturer or that, you know, that classmate,
yeah.
you know, that, you know, but does the evidence support that or is that true? Or, well, if I relied on that, you know, gravity, does it exist? If I jumped out a window, yes. would I fall flat to the pavement? You know, those things.
It's my opinion that I wouldn't.
Yes. Yeah. Which is not exactly helpful.
Yes.
You know? And that's the thing is where truth, where fact is becomes useful, that's where, you know, where opinion starts to go, you know, out the window. But politically is where opinion becomes useful.
I guess so. And maybe there needs to be a view to tone. But, yeah, it goes to the fact that we don't like hierarchies anymore.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we don't like the idea that, you know, you, associate professor of, that you're better than me.
Yeah.
But I'm prepared to admit that when it comes to their field of expertise, they are better than me.
Oh, me
I don't
too.
Take that personally.
Why I'd do so rather many people... an accountant do my tax
exactly.
than...
Exactly. Yeah. Why do so many people take that personally?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of... It's interesting because I don't want to get into other discussions today, like, you know, racism and all this sort of different things. Like, I believe in diversity. Anyone who's got a background in ecology will tell you that diversity is really healthy. So it's great that people are different.
Crucial for your ecosystem.
Healthy ecosystems have diversity. Healthy societies have diversity. People who are good at different things.
Tanya, you know how you're talking about before a title for a session on the sex life of crustaceans.
Yes.
A very great wit on text. Has said, I thought you were going to say got crabs. That's actually not bad. No, we're not going to talk about that. What is wrong with you? Are you having some fun as part of Science Week? Are you part of any presentations or events or the
like?
Oh,
yeah. I try not to be, but I always end up in something. So on Friday, I'm emceeing an event at Parliament House in Spring Street. Mm-hmm. So it's the Deakin Oration. We're having Tilman Ruff talking about nuclear disarmament and the recognition that you get with a Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, the science behind nuclear arms, nuclear weapons, and why there's a generation of young people who don't know a lot about it and why we're concerned about these things. So that'll be lovely. And then for the rest of it, I'm just a punter. You know, like I'll probably go to a couple events. I went to a great one last week in which there was a talk about the volcanic links between that led to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Because it's
volcanic links.
How? Yes. Oh, it's a bit obscure. But basically, in what is present day Indonesia, there was a volcano that erupted, a massive volcanic eruption that sent this ash cloud around the world that led to 3 years of winter. And it was during that long winter that she and her husband and Lord Byron and some of those other fabulous people of the time got together and told ghost stories and challenged each other to write a scary story. And that's where she got the idea to write Frankenstein, of which this year is the 200th anniversary of publication.
You see that the symmetry, the elegance of life and history, how all just can wrap itself up in a beautiful bow. I love it. Like crystal formation. Always perfectly symmetrical.
Oh, yeah. You see, that sort of, you see, this is what I love about science, you know, and Science Week is a chance for scientists to show who they are, because I think a lot of this post-truth society, some of the rejection of evidence is that people are scared of it. They don't understand and they don't see scientists at their day-to-day work. They know what a doctor does because you see them as a patient, but they don't know what scientists do. But I think science is comforting because there's chemistry, physical chemistry at the atomic level that tells you why those crystals form those particular shapes. And the fact that there's order in the universe when the world seems so messy.
I know.
Just gives me comfort.
I agree. Tanya Ha is my co-host for the Conversation Hour today. It's a science-focused Conversation Hour, which means you'll meet in a moment Professor Toby Walsh, Scientia Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of New South Wales. He leads the Algorithmic Decision Theory Group at Data 61. I know, it's all a bit tricky, but all will be explained. Stick with me.
Hey, Tanya. Virginia.
Yes, Tanya.
I've got that look on my face. You can only do the robo boogie if you've got the right algorithms.
She's here just to torment me today when it comes to the dreadful puns. Professor Toby Walsh does not have to laugh at those jokes. He's Scientia Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of New South Wales and the author of 2062. Yep, that's the date. The World That AI Made. Toby, good morning. Nice to see you.
Good morning.
Is that it? That's a cut off. That's the date at which we will hear that song played on the radio, but of course we'll be dead.
Well, hopefully we won't be dead, but it is the year when the majority of my colleagues expect that machines will be as smart as us, and shortly after that, probably they're going to be much smarter than us.
Smarter than us, define that. You mean that they'll actually have my intuition, they'll have my thinking process, they'll have my imagination?
They'll have your creativity, your emotional intelligence, your social intelligence, everything that makes us special, that made us the dominant species on the planet, we will no longer be.
No, they won't. No, they won't. Tell me how they will.
How they will? Well, if we pick a narrow focus task today, playing Go, reading x-rays, diagnosing eye disease, we already have machines that can do it at superhuman level. Mm-hmm. And there are some things still that we struggle to get. I mean, the human brain is something to be greatly admired. It's the most complex system on the universe that we know of by orders of magnitude. Nothing has the billions of neurons, the trillions of connections that the human brain has. But we are slowly chipping away at building machines that will do all of those different tasks. And it would be very presumptive to suppose that we won't eventually be able to build machines that can do the things that we do. Well, every time that we thought in a scientific sense that we were special, that the sun went round the earth or that we weren't descended from the apes, we were wrong.
Don't pull up that example.
There is nothing special about us. And we will probably make intelligence not in biology but in silicon.
So what would be the things that humans can do, will always be able to do better? Or, you know, always. Are there things that make humans particularly human that AI either won't be able to or
there are
do?
Some things we don't know machines will ever have. Will machines ever be conscious? Will machines ever have real emotions? We can give them fake emotions, but whether there is obviously a biochemical component of our emotions. So if we give machines emotions in silicon, whether they will ever be real emotions. And then the biggie, probably one of the most unknown scientific questions out there is, will machines ever become conscious? They don't have anything like consciousness today. But then consciousness is probably the most a difficult scientific question left. We have no idea what it is, so it's very hard to know whether, therefore, that means we'll never make it in silicon.
That's why I've enjoyed, or at least enjoyed, the first series of Westworld so much, because it was an entire drama program that was based on the idea of the acquisition of consciousness. Can it be learned? Can it be acquired? Can it actually be built up from a database over time? If you keep inputting enough data, will that machine become conscious?
We don't know. That's why the next 50 years is going to be really interesting from a scientific perspective. Maybe we'll build machines that are very smart but have no consciousness. They may be zombie intelligence.
It's very good to have these machines to do these useful things for us and diagnosis and the like and maybe even some tricky surgical things. But we don't have to keep building machines with artificial intelligence to take on more and more and more tasks that we are already good at. Why would we keep doing that?
Well, it's the four D's. We could build machines to do the dirty, the dull, the difficult, and the dangerous. And the other things we can do keep for ourselves. There are lots of things. We may be able to build machines that become creative and can write poems.
Why?
Yeah, that's the right question. Why would we bother? Even if they could make great art, would it be art that really speaks to us, but wouldn't speak to our humanity, our mortality, our loves, our losses? Because there'd be machines. They won't have any of those. And so we wouldn't care, even if they could paint as well as Van Gogh, if they could write poems as well as Shakespeare, we wouldn't care.
So continuing that then, is the pressure on to create those machines to do that stuff that we do well, and who wants it so badly?
Well, there is a pressure on, an economic imperative, an imperative to improve the quality of people's lives, to let the machines take over those jobs so that we can perhaps spend our times doing the things that are important to us.
No, my question went to, is there pressure anywhere to build machines to do that other stuff that we do so well in the creative realm?
Well, that's one that, like in reading your book that I thought was intriguing was the idea of, because it's the start of it, was robot carers in Japan where there's an aging crisis. So that's the sort of thing that I like to think that my children and grandchildren will be looking after me in my old age. I'd rather a human did it. Is that the kind of, but what are the economic realities and the things, the drivers?
Well, the social reality that your kids don't want to do it.
Yes. And in a country like Japan with an aging population and not so many children coming up, that may be the only choice. I think most of us would all prefer to have a human look after us, but maybe there is no choice. And there are many pressing problems where we might, for economic necessity, decide that we should get machines to do those tasks.
Does any of this alarm you?
Lots of it alarms me. That's why I wrote the book. It's not the sorts of things, though, that Hollywood would have you believe. It's not going to be
Terminator
taking over anytime soon. It's much more insidious things. And every day we open the newspaper and we see another example of how technology is starting to invade our lives. And we made perhaps a bad choice in how we let the technology invade our lives. And there's good things the technology can use and bad things.
Talk to us about the bad choices we know of so far.
Oh, hard to know where to begin.
Wherever you like.
I mean, just this morning you discover that Google is tracking you even when you turn off your location history. That is just bad behavior from the technology company, as usual. Right? You clearly indicated that you didn't want to be followed. You wanted to have some privacy. And yet, because we sign up to these free services, we let them get away with it. We shouldn't let them get away with it. Unfortunately, I think it's going to require more regulation. The tech companies now, the six biggest companies on the planet today, are all technology companies. And they've become monopolies. And like all big businesses, like big oil, big tobacco, big pharma, they eventually have to be regulated. The market doesn't work effectively for the common good unless we do eventually make sure that we put in the right regulations so that they are acting for all of our benefits, so that all of us share the prosperity that the technology will bring.
That's, you know, need more regulation. That's a hard one. I mean, not just locally, but globally. I mean, the comparison that I think is kind of interesting because it involves similar players is when we were first looking at the space race, there was international agreement about how you regulate space. And that was about agreements between governments. But it looks like the commercial space race is where things are really going to happen now.
Sadly, Trump has just announced the Space Force. So
I know.
The Space Force, the new arm of the US military.
Oh, the military up in space.
Yes.
Is there a need for them?
No. Well, there is a UN ban, of course, about weaponizing space to try and make the world a better place. And there are weapons. The Chinese and the Russians are believed to have weapons. And I imagine the US as well have weapons to destroy satellites. And when the bombs start dropping, no doubt they'll be trying to take out the satellites.
But that's the thing is, like, there's this, you know, we need that cooperation between countries. And if Google is, if we regulate in the US or regulate in Australia, how do we get a US-based or wherever-based company to...
Oh, that's easy enough. We've already discovered with the GDPR, the European Data Protection Act, what you do is you need a regulation that finds them as percentage of their global revenues, and then they sit up and listen.
Oh, okay.
But most of it actually doesn't require much new regulation. It's actually applying existing ideas. Most of it is just good old-fashioned bad behavior. Mm. Take Cambridge Analytica as another example.
Yeah.
Stealing people's private information without their consent and using that to manipulate election was, for thousands of years, bad behavior. And it still is bad behavior. Technology lets you do it quicker, cheaper, faster, but it's just bad behavior.
We've been talking so far, I guess, in sort of binary terms, if I can just drop that phrase in there, about the machines over there and humans over there. What about where we start to intersect, where either the machine becomes us or we become part of them? Will that happen by the time we hit 2062? What are the examples of that?
Well, we already hand over some of the things that we do to machines, and we outsource a lot of our memory these days to our smartphones. Whoever remembers a phone number anymore?
Yeah, right.
Who knows? We're probably the last generation, I suspect, that knows how to read a map. Mm. That will have given that over to the machines. Actually, that's an interesting example. You were asking earlier about how AI is entering our lives. Well, satellite navigation in your car, that's the example of AI. It was originally an algorithm designed in 1975 or so for Shaky the Robot. You wanted to tell Shaky the Robot to go to the library. It had to work out on its own how to navigate through the different rooms to get to there. So they wrote an algorithm that is now in everyone's satellite navigation, been repurposed to navigate not robots but humans.
But SatNav gets it wrong.
Well, because...
Don't say because it was programmed by humans. You can't say that, because I'll be driving down a street. I will see that sometime recently it's been blocked off. It's
yes.
asking me to turn left down that street. As a human, I make the assessment, dear SatNav, you don't know. You haven't been updated. Mm-hmm. I know better. So I'll continue straight rather than turning into a road that's been blocked off.
That's true of the SatNav in your car, but that's why people use things, services like Google Maps, because they get updated by sharing our collective experience, and it learns over time, just like humans learn over time. Mm. Just as you get experience, you learn where the rat runs are, you learn where the traffic lights are broken.
So the algorithm's only as good as the data it's drawing on, is it? Sort of
in part, like that? Yeah. And that's what we're discovering some of the challenges.
So with this intersection, if the machine becomes more human, will I become more machine?
Well, unfortunately, that's often the way that many jobs are going. We turn people, we make them much more systematic, so we do them more efficiently, and we turn humans into machines. And that's why actually replacing some jobs, I think, is a necessity. We're getting people to do inhumane things, and we should be rejoicing when we get a machine taking a human away from a task that is actually degrading for them.
Sure, but
you won't be plugged into a wall to recharge. Is that what you're... asking?
I plug myself into a wall to recharge every damn night, my friend, let me tell you.
I plug myself into coffee.
It's called the television. but where does the notion of error come into this? Because error and mistake and serendipity and coincidence, they're the features of our life that actually create the great moments and the great sparks. I met her by accident.
Mm-hmm.
I flipped the page to that, and all of a sudden I learnt that. And every other example that you can think of. I made a huge mistake, but as a result, this happened. How does that fit into machine thinking and the rise of AI?
It's a really fundamental old question. It goes back to Ada Lovelace, the very first female programmer who worked with Babbage back in the 18th century. And she made this very same objection, saying, you know, well, computers just follow rules and they will never be creative. And that is an interesting challenge. There is a field of a branch of computer science, of AI, called computational creativity, trying to work out, well, what are the rules of creativity? And you can teach people to be more creative. There are tricks you can do to make yourself more creative, and you can give those tricks to machines and make them. Then maybe they're not as, you know, we haven't built a Van Gogh yet or a Beethoven or a Shakespeare. But, you know, a machine has won a poetry competition. A machine has got to the final round of a short story competition. And you can see art made by paintings made by machines, and they're not bad.
But that's not creativity. That's probability. You know, remember that old saw of, you know, 1,000 monkeys in a room with typewriters, one of them will eventually type out Shakespeare. That's just probability. The probability being that if you had a million of them, the correct letters would be struck in the right order to give you Shakespeare, which, by the way, already existed before the monkey wrote it. But anyway, it's just a copying exercise. But that, again, it's probability, not creativity.
Yes. Well, but what is creativity? We don't have really a scientific understanding of what it is to be.
Some listening might say it's the guiding hand of God or the inspiration of the muse.
Ah, well.
Or I know, you can roll your eyes at that, but that's a key feature of the human brain as well. Some human brains.
Yes, and maybe it's all about our mortality and about, you know, our loves and our losses and all those important things that are important to us as humans and not part of the, you know, the scientific realm.
I'm trying to figure where you stand on this, Toby. For or again?
Oh, we'll get machines to make things that pass as fine art, but we won't care.
we'll care
about the thing that speaks to us because you've shared those same loves and losses that we've shared.
Because a lot of it comes down to utility. You know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, because I can't think of many people wanting to read what the other monkeys have produced with their typewriters. So some of these questions, like, I think, yes, you know, we can train computers to do things, but there's for what purpose, you know, to what end, and why? Who's deciding?
You see what's the traces of this in hipster culture already today.
What's that?
The appreciation of the artistic and the artisan, the things that are touched by the human hand. Mm. And we're willing to pay more, we're willing to go out of our way to find those things. And that's where many of the jobs of the future are, for example. I like to point out to people the newest job on the planet, being an Uber driver, probably the shortest lived job on the planet.
Sure.
We'll have autonomous taxis. It'd be far cheaper. The most expensive thing in your Uber is the person driving it at the front. It'd be far safer, far cheaper. Have a machine do that. And the oldest job on the planet, or one of the oldest jobs on the planet, being a carpenter, that's going to be one of the safest jobs, because we'll appreciate things that show the touch of a human hand. Mm. We'll appreciate the carpenter who tells the story of where they found the piece of wood and how they made that piece and what it speaks to.
So is there any part of you that's skeptical or fearful about the future, the future of AI?
I am quite pessimistic in the short term. It's going to be a very bumpy road. And I'm very optimistic in the long term. That's why I'm a scientist. I believe the only reason that we live better quality lives than our grandparents was because we embrace technology, we embrace science. And the only hope for all the wicked problems that face us today, climate change, the refugee problem, increasing inequality, stresses that the planet's being put through, is if we embrace the technology again, but use it in a good way. And we have to make some difficult choices.
Professor Toby Walsh, the dulcet tones you're listening to, Scientia Professor of Artificial Intelligence and author of, here's the year, mark it in your diary, 2062, The World That AI Made. The consensus year, you were saying, Toby, which most people working in this field believe the machines will be running the joint.
Yes, and there's a spooky, and this is not a scientific, but now one of these artistic things, a spooky coincidence, because when I finished writing the book and had given it to the publisher, I actually worked out that 2062 was the year that my daughter was my age, exactly. It's the year that she inherits. It's the year our children.
You see what I mean about nature?
I had never intended it to be that.
Exactly. But, you know, somehow the rhythm and the pattern and the symmetry just all works out. And you can't get a machine to do that.
It's the world our children inherit.
Yeah, exactly. Tanya Ha is my co-host. And in a moment, continue our science conversation, talking about, a wonderful gallery that you might not be aware of, because it doesn't really sort of have its permanent home yet, but it will. Science Gallery Melbourne, where art and science collide, and a great conversation to extend this idea of perfection in machine and perfection in human creation, perfection in humanity itself. Tanya Ha, Professor Toby Walsh, and myself are now joined by Rose Hiscock. She's the director of the Science Gallery in Melbourne, due to open as its own little building in 2020, but it's got temporary exhibition spaces in the meantime, but it's been having a very lively life right up until now. Rose, good morning. Nice to see you.
Good morning.
It's great to have you on board during Science Week because, mate, this is your week.
Yeah, we are popping. It's good times. It's fun times for those who work in science engagement.
So you've got an exhibition I'm on at the moment called Perfection.
We have an exhibition, The Planning. We pop up and open on the 12th of September. And so we are a gallery that will come into full-time existence in early 2021. But in the meantime, we're doing pop-up exhibitions.
And just sort of whatever space you can find?
Yeah, we're nomadic and it's deeply liberating to have no space. So for Perfection, we're in the University of Melbourne in the Melbourne School of Design, but we're also on the steps of the State Library in a truly unique environment.
Tell us about that. How's it going to work on the steps of the State Library? Or is it a spoiler alert we need to give?
No, I can I reveal everything. I'm an open book on perfection. It's such a fabulous theme. So we're taking the broad theme of perfection and we're looking at it from multiple dimensions and aspects. On the steps of the State Library, we're bringing a little glass box and we're pairing up an artist, a sci-fi artist, Lucy McRae, with a computer scientist, Niels Wolters, who is also working in AI and algorithms and you'll be scanned by a computer and you'll have a whole bunch of invasive information read back to you about your...
Cool.
This is the future.
We go on to the dark side. So we'll tell you about your age, your gender, but we'll also tell you your percentage weirdness, attractiveness, responsibility. And then we'll work alongside Lucy McRae, a sci-fi artist, who'll perfect your face using an algorithm.
Perfect my face.
Yes.
Oh, it sounds like Snapchat, but...
But worse.
Yes.
It's actually using an algorithm created by Dr. Stephen Mackard, who was the plastic surgeon to Hollywood stars, and he perfected a mathematical formula to conduct his plastic surgery. And so you say, well, you know, why on earth are we doing this? Why are we knowingly creating an algorithm that's at times may be false? And it's because we want to ask questions about where AI is going and where the fact that we're creating algorithms might be taking us.
Well, it has a long history. I mean, long before computers came along, there was an idea of perfection in human beauty and an idea of perfection in the built environment, in the building. The golden mean is a mathematical equation that will give you the most perfectly proportioned space and building. So the human mind has always tended towards perfection and wanting to achieve perfection and marry perfection and procreate perfection. So that's nothing new. We now just have to frame it, I guess, in the brave new world of AI.
Yeah, I mean, so our themes all come through think tanks and group conversations. And for us, our gallery is focused on young people, 15 to 25 year olds. So we went out and talked to them about what themes resonate. And this notion of perfection, both from the perspective of maths and physics and the universe, but through to psychology and where we're heading as humanity, resonated with that group. And we thought, right, we're onto something. Let's really explore it. And in doing a show about perfection, of course, we're interested in imperfection.
Well, it's interesting because it's that question of, you know, where is perfection an appropriate thing to strive for and where is it not a bit of an odd fit, you know, like in a... you know, what's a perfect face like and that sort of thing. And because some of it is beauty's in the eye of the beholder. But also, like, I think it gets
not
back
according
to the
machine, I reckon.
Yeah. I think it gets back to the things that you were talking about before, Virginia, about the messiness and the things that we respond to, the serendipity. Because
the scar on his face.
Yeah, like that.
The beauty spots on her
what's
face.
Because I find that idea of that you can have too much perfection. Tell us about that idea. Is it the uncanny valley or something like that where you can make things look more realistic, but when they look too perfect, people are turned off, say,
yes,
in computer animation.
The uncanny valley where if you get too close, then there's something a bit eerie, something a bit spooky about it until you get... it's about how people get deceived as well by things.
Is that the problem that some animators have come up against when they've made children's animations that get into that spooky zone of, well,
everyone's
that
too
face
shiny.
Just looks creepy. Yeah.
Yes, they're rather sort of zombie-like. And we're very good, though, when we get past that uncanny valley and making up for the mistakes that people make.
Well, perfection is central to the art of developing artificial intelligence, isn't it? I mean, isn't that your stock in trade, perfection?
Well, science is all about perfection. It's finding those mathematical truths. And there are absolutes to be had. And the science is, in some sense, the place where there is only the perfection to be found and everything else in the world is real and messy.
And so for us, introducing artists into the mix, it's like, in a way, throwing a hand grenade into the conversation.
Yeah.
Because we're interested in imperfection and we're interested in saying, well, there's so much pressure on young people to be perfect, to, you know, that there's a whole movement in sort of plastic surgery, in social media, in being being responsive. And so for us, we're really interested in exploring the fact that, well, what does that mean? What are the byproducts of perfection? What are the anxieties that sense of needing to strive for perfection causing? And therefore, what should we explore?
Rose, where did the idea of this gallery first come from, the Science Gallery of Melbourne?
So Science Gallery is part of an international network. So it started in Dublin in 2008 and at Trinity College Dublin with a remit for to inspire young people into the STEM disciplines. And being Science Week, we know those stats, you know, 75% of the future workforces in the STEM disciplines, only 16% of the current STEM qualified workforce are women. You know, we really need to inspire young people into the STEM disciplines, and so the gallery started in Dublin, and we are now building them around the world. So the Science Gallery London opens in September. A gallery will open in Bangalore, Venice, Detroit and Melbourne. So we're part of an international network.
And it's not a museum, it's a gallery. So therefore that connection and intersection with artists, with working artists is a crucial one.
That's right. Well, so we're interdisciplinary. Our job is to inspire young people into the sciences and into the creative industries. The Foundation for Young Australians has done some great research. One of their statistics is that a young person, a 15-year-old today, will have 17 jobs in their lifetime across five careers. So how do we prepare people for that kind of a future?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's where we come in.
Toby gave me a look. You do know, do you?
I think we do need to change how we educate people for these new jobs. We have to give people the grit, the adaptability, the ability to learn. Lifelong learning. You need to be taught at school how to learn. And there are the jobs that you will have in 30 years' time, one of the 15th job you have will be with a technology that was invented in 20 years' time. So we can't teach it to you at school today. We can't teach it to you at university. You have to be able to learn that as you go. You have to be given those skills.
So the key thing is problem solving. So how do we teach, you know, how do we learn to problem solve? And for us, you know, a university environment and a gallery that intersects arts and sciences uses a whole brain. It uses your curiosity, your creativity and your problem solving. So we're sort of training as we go through our program of exhibitions and events.
It's a really fascinating area. Is it to you, are the disciplines completely separate, Toby?
Not at all.
Okay.
Science is about being creative. It's about training your mind to ask those childhood questions. And so scientists have much to learn from artists in terms, because they are the ultimate creators, right? They know exactly how to create things. And so we should listen much more. It would be wonderful to have more dialogue.
You know, one thing that I did really enjoy about reading your book were your footnotes. your end notes, because, like, I was expecting references, but they were side comments, like sometimes,
you know, annotations.
and I thought that's kind of interesting because
scientists can have a sense of humour.
Yes.
I can pun as badly as you.
Oh, God, please don't.
Yeah. But you know what one mistake we've made is to leave advocating for science to the scientists. My view on this is that, you know, why have we done that? Why is not science everyone's business? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the business of actors, parents, godparents, grandparents, teachers, you know, community members. Mm. You know, it's our job collectively to be talking about science. It's not just the domain of scientists.
And sadly, of course, most of my colleagues are on the spectrum, so we're the worst people to try and communicate what we're doing. I apologise for myself and my colleagues.
No, not everyone on the spectrum is a bad communicator, mind you, but can get sort of focused, I guess, very, very, you know, strongly on one particular issue. Look, this kind of hooks back the point you're making making about it being everyone's job to advocate to a conversation we were having earlier on the program. And we were talking about homework and how reading is considered part of homework, which bothers me that it's even considered in the same framework as homework. Reading is everything.
It's recreational.
Reading, exactly. It's life, it's creativity, it's your internal life, it's your imagination, stories we tell each other, we tell ourselves. That, to me, has to be separated out and not lumped in. We made a mistake, didn't we, in thinking of so many interesting things in the world and calling it science, which immediately for some kids and in some schools becomes, oh, that tricky subject, science, whereas no. It's actually just the way your body is, the way the world works, what you see, and the extraordinary consequences of certain actions and incidents.
Yeah, and the best example of that is the Aboriginal people and First Nations people perspective of arts and science. So if you think about, land, law, astronomy, custom, cultural rights of Aboriginal people, of course the sciences and the arts were totally enmeshed and part of a holistic view of life and land. And I think that's really, we need to learn from that process and that way of being and think about that into the future.
Yeah, it's not a school subject or discipline.
No.
It's actually the lived experience of being in the world.
Well, and you've both said this word to me that's utterly key to this, and that's stories. And one thing that never ceases to amaze me is that, evidence-based scientists sometimes ignore the evidence from psychologists that humans respond to stories.
Yeah.
We have emotions, we don't. There's a lot of people who think that, we can change people's minds by giving them the facts and data.
Hmm.
It's, humans, we're not always rational actors.
No, scientists, we are. We're entirely logical. That's the problem.
No, you're not. You're driven by the same anxieties, fears, desires, lusts, anger,
biases.
So when it comes to storytelling then, because I hear what you're saying about 2026 and all the jobs are going to go and bloody, bloody, blah, but they won't get my job sitting here because, I don't know, can your machine tell stories like I can?
We are building machines that can tell stories, yes. They're not.
What kind of stories? Are they as good as my stories?
Well, one got to the final round of a short story competition. We go back to, we care. We prefer to hear your interesting stories and the fact that you can speak to our experiences because you're another human being. And that will matter more to us than a machine that can do the job better with fewer mistakes, without any blank air. It will do the job better than you, but
it won't
be human.
Do your artists that you engage with, Rose, do they divide the world into the creatives and the AI, or do they see that intersection as much more fluid now?
I think it's much more fluid, and it's more of an integrated practice. So we're working with artists across the sciences. So say biohacking, which is essentially implanting wearables into your body. So there are biohackers who have their transport cards implanted into their hands.
Mm.
So for those artists, they're questioning where science is going through immersive technology. So, look, I think it's very fluid.
Don't do this at home, children.
No, I just think that I'm sure I've got allergies. I'm sure I'd react to a Mikey implanted
there
in me.
There was an awful story about that actually in the news this week about a woman who, by a body-modifying artist, had a snowflake inserted underneath her skin, and she died from septicemia. But that's not an AI issue. That's just simply a poor health control issue.
No, that's right. And the Four Corners. If anyone watched Four Corners this week around
plastic surgery.
Surgery. But, there are ramifications for these. But however, people are doing these kinds of things, so we need to talk about it.
It goes back to our ideas of perfection. What is beauty? Mm. Is it a snowflake under your skin?
Is it a perfect
set of lips?
That's right. So we look forward to the Perfection exhibition in September. And then your permanent home, where will that be exactly?
It will be on the corner of Grattan and Swanson Street, the former women's hospital site, which we're redeveloping as an innovation precinct. The University of Melbourne is developing as a full innovation precinct. So we'll open early 2021, and until then we're popping up around Melbourne.
Here, there and everywhere. Who's designing the building for you?
It's a Woods Bagot design.
Lovely, very nice. I think they may have done this one too, is that right? Fact check, we'll find that out. Toby, congratulations on the book, and I hope to see you in, human form for a lot longer. I don't want the machines to completely take you over. Do your children agree with your hypothesis?
I think they do, yes.
You think they do. We'll have to, you have to
cross only time will tell.
That's right.
He just and hopes he doesn't have to teach them how to drive one day. That's what he's working on.
And National Science Week on now until the 19th of August. If you only had time to pick one or two events, Tanya Ha, what would they be? Come on. You can say one that you're involved in. I don't mind.
Okay. I'm intrigued by one on at Royal Society of Victoria that's on Saturday night. It's Is Your Brain Racist? I'm intrigued by it. Like, what's the neuroscience of prejudice?
There's actually a neuroscience for it. So do we mean here nurture rather than nature, nature versus nurture?
It's about your brain taking shortcuts, and I believe. So there's a US researcher who's coming out who's giving that talk. So I don't know a lot about it. I just saw the title and I thought, I'm so intrigued. But there's many, many, many events still on. So if you want to go to scienceweek.net.au, you can search on your suburb and find out what's
you
on
certainly
your local
can.
Area.
Tanya, Toby, Rose, thanks so much. Great company and great conversation, as you can always expect on The Conversation Hour. And thank you for your company as well. We're back tomorrow on this program from 8:30 and The Conversation Hour at 11 o'clock, of course, on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.